Welcome back to Birds of a Feather Talk Together. This week we talk about one of Shannon's favorite birds, the brown creeper. The way these tiny little birds climb all over trees and look like a piece of bark is truly amazing and adorable. We also answer a mailbag question about evolution and when animal learned how to fly. After that, we get into the next round of our round robin tournament and vote on the second round of birds from our previous episodes. Okay, go grab your binoculars and let's get into it.
Can't be
Wait a minute.
Good
you,
enough at
you
it.
You don't like playing Monopoly.
No, because you and Peter mean. That's right. Playing Monopoly, it does not bring out your better side. Trust me. Or our son's better side does not come out during Monopoly games.
Monopoly's too long.
I don't. That's
yeah. I agree.
I never finished. Yeah,
I know. Yeah. There is no end in that game either. Yeah.
Well, there is when people are mean.
Okay. I was going to say, I don't think I've ever played in the game like ended by like normal means. Yeah. Like people just got bored.
One thing I do like about Monopoly, though, is that they make a lot of local Monopoly games. So there's a Trail British Columbia Monopoly game.
No way.
Which is pretty fun. Oh. Which is hard sometimes because there are almost no streets. So
I've seen that like with colleges. Like, yeah, like different universities have their own or whatever.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
I want to see the trail one.
Yeah.
Do you
there
have
must
it?
Be a bird Monopoly, right?
Yeah, I is agree.
There?
There's
there
got to
be.
I don't think so, because I think it's so geography-based. I don't know.
I bet there is.
I'll look it up. Yeah.
I don't know, because that would...
We can put it with our wingspan.
That's what I said. If it exists, we're getting it for Christmas next year. Yeah.
All right. Well, welcome back, everyone. This is RJ. I'm with Amanda and John and Shannon, and Luis is joining us as well, and we're going to talk about the brown creeper this week. And so brown creeper was not a bird that I was super familiar with. I've seen him, I think, in the wild, but I was excited when Shannon brought it up to learn more about it. So, Shannon, this was your suggestion. Do you want to kick it off?
Yeah. When I first started at the museum, people always asked you, what's your favorite this, that, or the other thing? And it terrified me at first because I didn't know what to say. After a while, it became bluebird of paradise, my favorite specimen. And then people would say, what's your favorite North American bird? And I just love brown creepers. I think they're tiny and adorable, and they move so interestingly in trees. So they're not the most spectacular to look at, brown, blacks, a little bit of white. But if you ever watch them, the way they climb up and down trees is absolutely and utterly charming. Mm-hmm. And there are other things that you see when you could see them up close that make them look like cute versions of woodpeckers, because they have really stiffened tails. So they will go up a tree and fly back down and go back up, fly back down. And they use their tail to brace themselves against the tree. So they have little feet, little legs, because the taller you are, the more you're going to fall back, right? So they have little tiny short legs, which maybe I resonate with that too, and stiffened tails to brace themselves against the tree, and they have decurved beaks to probe inside of bark, and I just think they're adorable.
They look like a little piece of bark. Like it looks
on
like
purpose,
there's like a piece of bark just kind
and
of hopping
hang
around
deliberately sometimes to look like pieces of bark. Absolutely. I wish we had them more in our backyard, but there's one every once in a while in one of the trees in the backyard.
Well, this is a bird that across eastern North America in the next couple of weeks, you know, the entire population is going to start moving out of their wintering grounds and coming through places like Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a very common bird in certain times of the spring migration, early spring migration in Chicago. So they'll be coming through, and I think it's easy to overlook them. And what I think about them is like every once in a while you're just walking along and you just spot this weird movement in the corner of your eye, and you look over at a tree and you think, there's going to be a brown creeper there. And sure enough, then it'll just start hitching its way up the tree like Shannon's been describing. And they have a very big range. They go all the way up to Alaska, and all the way through the west and the mountains, and then all the way across the eastern deciduous forest, at least in the non-breeding season. And then they'll winter up in they breed. There are a few individuals that breed in northern Illinois, for instance, that were right at the southern edge of their breeding distribution. But so they'll go all the way up to tree line.
They have been under concern historically because of alteration of forests. Mm-hmm. So they like mature trees. They like leaves. They like dead bark on trees. They like dead trees. And if you start manicuring your forests and logging them and taking out all that stuff, there's not as much habitat for them. I mean, I don't think they're endangered now, but there have been concerns raised about deforestation and its effect on brown creepers. Mm. And we have, can you guess how many we have?
I'm going to guess we have 1,200.
What do you think, Louise?
$1,300.
I was surprised. Right. Yeah. We have 3,454 right now. That's a lot of adorable little tiny birds.
Are they a common salvage?
They are. I don't think they're in the top. They're not in the top 10, but they're not far out of it.
Is it like during migration that they? Mm-hmm.
They'll hit the windows. And and one good thing about them is they're so small and they don't weigh very much that I think a lot of individuals survive.
Oh, good.
And as a matter of fact, that's actually one of the more amazing birds in the collection from my perspective with respect to the window kills is an individual that we have that's banded. And the story on this bird is that when it came in, you can read the Fish and Wildlife Service band and you can turn it in and find out when it was banded. And so it was prepped. They sent the banding number in and the band number came back. And that bird had been picked up by the Chicago Collision Monitors a year before on the very same day that the window had hit a year later, building over. And I always like to point out that with the 40,000 some specimens we have that have hit windows.
40?
60?
100,000?
Yeah, 100,000. What that really doesn't necessarily tell you anything about the timing of brown creeper migration per se. It's just the fact that when you have that many individuals, you may end up with an oddball story like that. Mm. But clearly that bird was picked up having hit a window, was fine, taken out to the rehab station, banded, and then it came back through, went to the wintering grounds, and then hit the windows after that.
There's tons of variation, too. I think there's between 10 and 15 described subspecies. There's been genetic work done on them, and there is population structure in these birds.
And so what causes that, then? Like, we talked about the starling, and they have, like, no genetic variation of the ones in North America, but it sounds like brown creeper have a lot. So what?
That's an interesting question with respect to. So, for instance, starlings in their native range, I should know. I don't know whether they have much geographic variation. We had talked a little bit in one of the previous episodes about the European goldfinches, and they have a bunch of different populations. And you know, most of the time, what you can see in those situations is that those populations correspond to geographic regions with somewhat of different histories, or you may be in a little different climate. So if it's drier, a lot of times you'll get populations that are paler. Mm-hmm. And coming back to brown creeper, that's an interesting thing because they're pretty consistent in basically living in mature forests, as Shannon was saying. And so it's, to me, it's always been kind of surprising that you would have that much. And it's, if you looked at them in the museum, this is not, the variation is fairly subtle. I mean, a brown creeper looks like a brown creeper. They're not, you're not going to see a pale white brown creeper from a desert situation because they just don't occur like that. But clearly, like, for instance, populations in the Appalachians could be different from the populations in eastern Canada. And then you've also got to look at it from the perspective of the geographic history of North America. And so we know that during the ice ages, there were large sheets of ice that were pushing all these forest birds into little enclaves around the edges of the southern part of North America. And then they expanded back out after the ice receded. And so that gives you the possibility of having a population have enough time to differentiate and then maintain that differentiation over time.
So do they stay isolated then in these little groups?
Yeah, so I think the quick answer is it depends. And that's an, you know, an active area of study. And so it's interesting because so the family Certhiidae has a number of species in them, and so they're very similar looking creepers in Europe that do the same kind of Europe and Asia that do the same kind of thing, that have these populations that were clearly pushed down during the Pleistocene and the glacial maxima and have come back. And so, yeah, I mean, sometimes those populations merge into one another and you don't see any differentiation. And other times there may be some aspect of the genetic variation when they come back together that's enough to maintain them as separate units.
And do they have something we noticed when we were watching videos and looking at pictures is their feet. They have like special feet.
They're a member of the Passeriforms. They're a perching bird. And they probably have some major they have claws that are longer than a lot of other birds like that and really sturdy in order to help them grip the bark. And then, as Shannon was saying, they've got this modified tail that allows them to stabilize themselves as they're going up and down trees. The bill is really neat because it's this tiny little long, thin bill that they use to probe in. And one of the interesting things about them is, you know, we were saying they're migratory. They're not necessarily do all individuals migrate. And we were in British Columbia in Shannon's hometown of Trail a couple years ago in the middle of winter, and I went up into the mountains and I was, you know, there are these incredible spruce and fir trees that are just incredibly densely foliated. And I was making noise and getting chickadees to come in, and suddenly there was a brown creeper. And what I was realizing is, you know, as bad as and cold as it can be up in the mountains of British Columbia, the inside habitat along the edge of those trees is probably full of bugs' eggs, and you're pretty buffered from the outside weather. And so, you know, I think even a little bird like a creeper can persist in some of that.
Yeah, I think I read that they can go up to like 11,000 feet, like basically the tree line. And when trees stop growing, that's kind of when they max out as far as like elevation, which I thought was pretty fascinating.
There's some absolutely wonderful photos of something else they do, which is they'll form these communal roosts. So they'll find holes, and they've got these pictures of like 10 of them in a little circle where they're all just sort of packed into a hole, into the bottom of a hole with their tails coming out and heads in to maintain warmth over, you know, a cold night.
Wow.
So they can, they, yeah.
I told you they're adorable.
Yeah. I was going to say, when I picture like how a nuthatch moves up and down a tree, would it be similar to how a creeper is moving?
Nuthatches go up and down too, but there's, even if you catch a creeper out of the corner of your eye, you know what it is. It moves differently than other birds, even though superficially they might do the same thing, climb up and down, but not the same, not so similarly that you would mistake them. I mean, creepers, if you start paying attention to things, and creepers just move differently. They move differently when they're flying, not just when they're going up and down a tree, too.
But they won't go face down the way the nuthatches will.
Oh, okay.
And so that's an interesting difference between them.
So they'll fly down? Is that what you guys are saying?
Okay. Yeah, they make these little flights, and then they'll work their way back. And then they also can move sideways really well, too. And so that's one of the – I always love when woodpeckers and creepers and things, like, it's clear that that's one of the ways in which they avoid detection is if, like, they see you first, they're likely to just slip around behind the back of the tree.
Yeah.
And
then, but it turns out nuthatches – are in the same part of the tree of life as creepers. And they used to be that creepers were thought to be related to chickadees, but that's not actually the relationship when people started using DNA.
Oh, okay.
They're actually closer to nuthatches.
Oh, interesting.
But there are also some other families, like Australian creepers, which have long, thin bills and tend to hitch up trees and are not closely related. And so it's a morpho. And then there are also these birds called wood creepers down in South America, which is they're even part of this sub-ossine radiation of birds, of passerine birds, which is different than the ossine songbirds. And they're bigger in size, but they do the same kind of thing movement-wise, where they have a long, thin bill, very sturdy tail. They're brown with white streaks, and so they're very similar looking, and just, you know, it's a morphology that's evolved multiple times across birds.
Form follows function. So if you're going to make a living going up and down trees, you better not break your tail, because you get help eventually, in an evolutionary sense. I know that sounds really anthropomorphic, but you will evolve structures that will facilitate the way you move.
And if you don't want to be seen in a tree, being brightly colored like a European goldfinch, for instance, may not be the best thing for you. And so they look like bark, and it's amazingly effective.
I saw online that the oldest brown creeper was banded in Illinois in 2010. I was just curious if you guys know who banded it or...
How old was it?
It was 5 years and 5 months.
It wouldn't be completely surprising to find out that that was actually a bird from the collision monitors or from that data set. I don't know that.
Yeah,
but,
okay.
But certainly one of the things that... When you have that 3,000 in the collection, you have the chance of getting returns like that. I wonder, in Illinois, one of the interesting things about them is the places they breed are places that they breed almost every year. And so people get to know them. So it's possible that somebody actually caught one of those, because I wouldn't be surprised that there are fewer than 20 pairs in Illinois.
Oh, wow.
So they're literally just in these small numbers of locations up in northern Illinois for the most part.
Wow.
And so maybe somebody did catch one and then banded it and was able to actually catch it again later on.
When I was looking up information on them, they have clutches of 5 to 6 eggs, which seemed like a lot to me.
So tiny.
Does that seem like a lot to you?
I mean, yes, and yet, you know, chickadees have 9 to 10.
Oh, wow.
And so they're...
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
such a little body.
I think nesting birds a lot of times tend to have... Some of those birds have pretty big clutch sizes.
Wow.
But that, yeah. And again, it, I think it's interesting what you were saying about the... You can imagine. So when Europeans moved across, they basically deforested most of Pennsylvania and New York at some point. And that's all reforested. Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of... areas where there were probably lots of brown creepers before the forest was cut down, and it's taken a long time for those populations to begin to come back.
Well, is there anything else brown creeper related we want to talk about before we get into anything else?
Well, I'll just say that they have a really high call that I often can't hear.
Oh.
And that's one of my big disappointments, is no longer be able to readily pick
it. I bet you can with your
might
new
now,
hearing
with
aids.
My hearing aids now.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, John, are you saying that the brown creeper that I see in Jackson Park is probably the same brown creeper every time I see it?
Yeah. No. So the answer to that is probably not.
Oh, okay.
Because there's so many coming through on migration. But for instance, Skokie Lagoons has a breeding pair that... one of the local birders, Jeff Bilski, seems to be able to find almost every year.
Wow. Okay.
And so I would think that in that case, as long as that pair's there, it's a reasonable chance that it's the same individuals.
That's awesome.
Go and look at the bark on trees. You never know what you're going to find. You may find one of the most adorable birds in North America on your tree.
Well, keep Look closely, because there are a lot that come through on migration, and so you can see them, and they're just really cute little birds.
That's awesome.
Well, we do have a mailbag question I was going to read. So this is Rex from Streeterville, Illinois. And Rex says, from an evolutionary standpoint, when did birds or any kind of animal learn to fly? I know life started in water and then evolved to land. How did a species make the next step to be able to fly?
So we actually just read a paper for Lab Group today that was a phylogeny basing of all the major orders of birds. And one thing we know is that the ancestors of birds were flighted. Mm-hmm. So birds, by and large, had wings. And so flight in birds was always possible. And then they've evolved all these situations where flight's been lost, and ostriches and rheas and kiwis and cormorants in the Galapagos and things. But with respect to water, what he's talking about is that we think that vertebrates evolved in water and then gradually got to land. And that was a long time before the appearance of birds.
So this was a really interesting question, because it made me think of how I talk about what a human is. Mm-hmm. So you can't just de novo start flying. There's a series of evolutionary steps that have to happen before you can fly. Mm-hmm. So you have to have feathers, and feathers predate birds. So there's lots of dinosaurs that have feathers. Archaeopteryx, 140 million? I don't remember how old Archaeopteryx is. They had feathers, almost certainly could fly. And so, you know, what's a bird? That is a very hard question to answer. It's not a thing with feathers. That used to be an easy definition, right? Oh, it has feathers, but no. Lots of things had feathers before birds came along. And so there had to be a series of steps that could happen before flight could do. You had to make your skeleton really light. You had to make sure you had breast muscles that could actually power flight. And all of those things happened before you got to what we would call modern birds. And so for me, that's a really interesting question to think about. Just like we think we know what a human is, but we don't.
Well, and I mean,
most of the adaptations you have as human happened along the tree of life of primates before you ever got to that. So humans didn't invent all the things that we think of as uniquely human. It's just that these combinations of things have to happen before the thing that you think of as human can happen. You know, we're not the only things with opposable thumbs, for example.
But, with mammals, it's the same kind of situation where you think the first mammals were little things scurrying around on the ground, but eventually they made whales and bats and elephants. And so, you know, it's incredible what can happen over evolutionary time.
There used to be a person who researched here. Now he's a curator of dinosaurs at the Smithsonian. And he has done a lot of work on this. And so, you know, we were talking about flight predating modern birds to roughly 160 million years. So that was flight. Other things flew too, like pterodactyls. Obviously bats learned to fly too as vertebrates. But so flight is old. The way birds do it is less old.
Huh. Hmm.
But birds didn't invent flight. They didn't invent feathers. They didn't invent light skeletons. They didn't invent keels, and they didn't invent big breast muscles to attach to the keels so you can have a powered flight.
Hmm.
So, yeah. So evolution, all these things don't happen at one time to make the one thing you think of as special, special. That's really not how it works.
And Shannon, what are keels?
A keel is the breastbone. So if you dissected a chicken, you know, you see this big breastbone. And if you're going to have a powered flight, you have to have a lot of muscle. Mm. And you have to have a place for the muscle to attach. And so they built a ridge. Birds have evolved a ridge in their skeleton to have a place for the muscles to attach to. And so I remember reading this a long time ago, that if you were a hummingbird, your keel would stick out 3 feet from your chest.
Oh my gosh.
So think about the mass of muscle that it takes to be a hummingbird.
Wow.
And if you were an owl, your eyes would take up most of your face. So there's all these kind of comparisons that people have done that are really fascinating to think of, how big your eyes would be if you were an owl.
Yeah, and there are interesting things like there's almost no keel on Archaeopteryx. And so the implication there is that however it was moving its wings, it probably wasn't really good at flying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and birds have weird lungs too. So if you're going to have this powered flight, you need to oxygenate your body all the time. And so there's like weird ways that air, different ways from other vertebrates, that air moves through air sacs and the lungs of birds. And I don't think you're not going to be an albatross if you don't have, if you're not adapted, your lungs aren't adapted to these kind of flying conditions.
And haven't there been some studies that, obviously feathers and all of that predates flight, probably developed for other reasons first. But I know that they've done like some experiments with baby or juvenile birds that when they're walking up an incline, they instinctively flap their wings, even though they're not formed and they can't fly yet. And so that was maybe like for balance or something when walking up inclines or running up inclines.
Yeah, there's a historical controversy in birds, whether flight originated from the ground up, like Louise is just describing, or from the trees down. And for a long time, people thought it made logical sense that you would glide from it. You'd be up in a perch, you'd glide, and then eventually you'd get powered flight. But now I think most of the people who study these things think that it came from the ground up, that these balancing exercises, and eventually, you know, your wings get a little bit longer and a little bit more aerodynamic, and you get up into the air when you're running. And you can kind of see that when you watch birds running. So I don't know. It's pretty interesting.
Just like the Wright brothers.
Well, yeah, but they didn't know enough about birds, or they would have solved their problems a lot earlier.
You got to start somewhere.
The flight is extraordinarily complicated, and it takes a lot of technology to mimic what birds have evolved to do. So humans figured it out in a fairly short period of time. It took hundreds of millions of years for birds to get to there.
Well, that was an awesome question, Rex. Yeah, we appreciate that.
That's a great question.
Yeah,
for sure.
So should we do our next round robin?
Yes, let's do our next round robin.
All right. So we have the birds of paradise against the woodcock.
Birds of paradise.
I'm going woodcock.
I'm going woodcock.
I'm going woodcock.
No way. I'm outvoted? You guys are wrong. Oh, my goodness.
All right. Woodcock it is. Sorry, Shannon.
I don't approve. I need time to change your mind.
I'm just pointing out that my bracket is already busted.
Yeah. Well, you are a University of Arizona fan. Since 15 repeatedly. So.
It's madness. All right. Next up is the purple martin against the great horned owl.
You're killing me.
I'm going purple martin this time in an upset.
Yeah. I'm going purple martin.
Yeah, I think I would go purple martin.
Okay, I'm going purple martin too.
I'm going purple martin.
Right.
Oh,
sorry, owl. Sweet.
Your eyes are really cool, but you're not iridescent.
And then next up is the roseate spoonbill against the Willard Sooty Boo-Boo.
Oh, now you're tugging at our hearts.
Yes, yes.
I have to have the boo-boo.
I'm a boo-boo, too.
I'm going boo-boo.
All right, it's unanimous.
All right. Louise wants back in the bird division.
All right, and then last matchup of this round is vampire finches against the shoebill.
Oh, my God, that's impossible. Shoebill.
Oh, shoebill.
I'm going shoebill.
Shoebill.
Yeah. It has to be.
Shoebill is the number one seed in this tournament, in my opinion.
If they didn't choose it, it would just They're look a powerhouse. So angry at us.
Exactly.
For not choosing it.
Yeah. We'd be hoping we weren't a lungfish. Yeah.
All right. So next week, we'll see who advances to the final four.
All right. Sweet.
That's everything for our round robin tournament this week. All right.
That was hard.
I know. Thanks everyone for joining us. All week we'll be posting matchups for you to vote on in the next round of our round robin tournament, and we'll be posting the results as well. This will all be happening on our Instagram at Birds of a Feather Podcast. Next week we'll release the next round of voting, and eventually we'll crown our champion. We're looking into getting stickers made of the winner for winners for our voters, so stick around for more info on that. Thanks to Daniel, our audio engineer, as well as Earhole Studios in Chicago for helping us record. You are all amazing. All right, see everyone next week. Love you all. Thanks.